dream possible before this happened. They're thinking that, even as we sit around this table talking about rations, the nobility of our college president, they debate whether to shoot and eat our dogs. John winced at that. Of course, Washington didn't know about this morning, nor did he notice John's reaction. The phone rang. The sound of it when it did happen was still rather startling. The three looked at one another, and John stood up, went over to the president's desk, and picked up the receiver. It was an old rotary phone from the 40s or 50s, receiver heavy, wire not even the coiled type yet, just jet black and hanging down.
"Matheson here. John, is that you? It's Tom here. Go ahead, Tom. I'm here with Don Barber. I just picked him up and brought him to the town hall.
What did he see?
Damn, John, he's pretty shaken.
Can you bring him up?
Sure, John. We'll be there in 5 minutes.
Over here.
The line continued to hum for several seconds until Judy, the switchboard operator at the town hall, pulled the connect and the line went dead. John hung up.
I think we got problems. Barbara will be here in a few minutes with his report.
They just made small talk as they waited, John standing, looking out the window, smoking what was now his 7th cigarette of the day. A group of students was coming down from behind the upper men's dorm. Half a dozen girls and a couple of guys. The granola crew, they were called, and though they were mildly disdained before the day, no one mocked them now. Most of them were outdoor ed or bio majors, and had become highly proficient at food gathering, knowing which roots to dig, which plants could be brewed into teas, which had some medicinal value. One of the girls had a copy of Peterson's Guide to Plants, dirty and worn, in her jeans pocket. Another girl was carrying a basket filled with mushrooms. So far there had been no mistakes on that score. Another was being helped by a boy, the woven basket between them piled high with greens. The boy and girl looked like some Rousseau ideal, a fantasy of the way the world was supposed to be if civilization went away. The antique World War II Jeep, which Tom had designated his official squad car, turned the corner and pulled up to Gaither. Barber got out along with Tom, and they came straight in. Barber saw the cigarette in John's hand and sighed.
"Damn, I haven't had one of those in years," he said softly. "John, could I?"
John hesitated, nodded, and handed one over. He was now down to 11. Don took a deep drag, sighed, went over to the table, and sat down.
"They're coming," he said.
No one spoke.
"Old Fort is a wreck. I flew down there first. At least 50 vehicles loaded with—"
He paused, took another drag, and then waved his hand in a gesture of disgust.
"I can't even find a word to describe the scum. They were in the center of the town, most of it burning. There's fighting going on even now, but that town is finished."
He sighed and looked out the window.
"Shit. It was like Korea in 51. If only I had a battery of 105s up here, we could have annihilated their advance guard with one salvo."
"Advance guard?"
Washington asked. Barber nodded.
"Give me a minute, Washington. My brain's a bit slower now. Let me tell it in order."
No one spoke.
"Like I said, about 50 vehicles. Most in the center of the town, those barbarians just running amok. I could see them gunning people down right in the middle of the street, flushing them out of buildings they were setting on fire. Out on the interstate, about 10 more vehicles. They took a couple of pot shots at me. You'll see a dozen or so holes in my plane, by the way. So I figured to check up the road, fly up along Route 70, then come back down along the interstate. There wasn't much on 70, though it was obvious they had passed along it. Buildings burning, but a couple hundred yards back from the road I could see people out, still alive. It looked like they just were driving straight through. Marion wasn't hit hard. Just off the interstate enough, I guess, to be bypassed. Plus they had well-manned roadblocks and the access ways in. Some evidence of fighting, but looks like the scum backed off."
"Think they'll back off here?" Tom asked.
"No,"
John said forcefully.
First off, their spies have scoped us out. They know we still do have some resources. Second, to get into Asheville, a sweet big city to loot, they first have to go through us. Third, they are heading this way and there is now no backing off. Marion, they might mark for later, but I think it's here first.
Washington nodded his agreement. What happened next, Don? John asked.
I pushed on to Morganton, down to exit 103 on the interstate.
He lowered his head.
I thought Charlotte was bad when I flew around it back when things started. That was different, though. In Charlotte there was rioting, yes, but people were mostly just trying to snatch and grab, or just getting the hell out. This was different.
How so, sir? John asked.
You know the mental hospital grounds there?
All nodded. Rowan, the state mental hospital, was set back from the interstate about half a mile. Beautiful, open lawn. Surrounded by the old, sedate southern town of Morganton, complete with some antebellum homes on the main street.
A fucking nightmare!
John was shocked by Don's language. He was a devout, church-going man.
How bad? Washington asked.
My God, I think they're killing people and eating them, he whispered.
No one spoke for a moment. John just staring off, puffing on his cigarette right down to the filter.
You're kidding, Charlie whispered.
Don looked over at him fiercely.
Would I joke about that? He snapped. There were a couple of hundred vehicles parked on the grounds of the hospital in a big circle, like they were circling the wagons. Old cars, jeeps, trucks, even a couple of tractor-trailers. Inside that circle, the ground was blackened from a huge fire that was still smoldering. It was early when I flew over there. You could see them just sprawled out, sleeping it off. The hospital was burning, dead scattered all around it, most of the downtown burning as well, dead carpeting the streets. But it was what was inside that circle of old cars, trucks, motorcycles.
He finished the cigarette, stubbed it out in an empty coffee cup, and looked, appealing, at John. John handed him another and pulled one out for himself. It was down to 9 now. They had something like a gallows set up. Bodies were hanging from it. Don shook and started to cry.
They were cut open, some without legs and arms, 10 or more like that, like hogs hung up to be butchered. My God!
He fought for composure.
You could see other people who were prisoners. As I flew over, they were looking up at me, starting to jump up and down, waving like poor bastards stranded in a nightmare. I sideslipped to get down lower for a closer look. One of those scum, I could see him looking up at me, and as I flew over, he cut a woman's throat. Cut it so I could see it. That's when I almost got shot down. They have an automatic, and it opened up, stitched my starboard wing. I dived down low, skimmed over not a dozen feet high, weaved and dodged. He smiled. Like the old days. Damn, I was good then. Could put my spotter between 2 trees not 30 feet apart with telephone wires waiting on the other side.
And then he seemed to unfocus again.
I don't want to believe what I saw.
John sighed, sat back, lost in thought. Cannibalism. Leningrad, Stalingrad. With those cases, it was civilians driven mad by hunger. Reports as well in China, and, frightfully, documentation of Japanese soldiers doing it, either out of desperation when cut off by the island-hopping campaign, or ritualistically against American POWs.
"Not here," Charlie sighed. "Not here. This is America, for heaven's sake."
"Yes, here," John said softly. "Why should we be any different?"
"Damn it all. We're Americans. It just doesn't happen here."
"Donner Pass? The Essex? Jeffrey Dahmer? Our sick fascination with films about that Lecter character? 60 days with little or no food just because the electric suddenly shut off?"
"Hell yes," John said coldly. "Most likely some damn cult down there. Like Doc said, psychotics running loose." The cult over in Knoxville, with its leader proclaiming he was John the Baptist reincarnated, was still running. There were reports of others, some nutcase proclaiming he was the Messiah, others speaking in tongues and looking for answers in Revelation, others just beyond madness, believing that aliens had invaded. He thought of that one small coven up above Haw Creek, a couple of dozen families in a church, which, according to rumors not long ago, was into passing snakes around. They had sealed themselves off completely, said that it was the end time and God's wrath was at hand. No one dared to even get within 100 yards of their barrier now, and John wondered what madness they were practicing up there. "They have nothing to lose now," John continued. "A nation under martial law? They've looted, raped, murdered. They know that if civilization ever gets the upper hand again, any semblance of order, all of them, will be put against the wall and shot. So, nothing to lose. Mix into that the terror of it all. We figured out it was an EMP, but others, especially others who were already off kilter, what's the answer? God got angry? Gaia, the Earth Spirit, got pissed? Satan took over?" He found he was almost on the edge of hysteria himself. His hand shaking slightly, he pulled out another cigarette and tossed yet another over to Don. "Satan's taken over. Maybe whoever's leading them is preaching that. God has turned his back on America, Satan has won, so anything goes. I doubt if all of them are doing it. I want to think most of them are as terrified of whoever is running their crew as we are. But I'm willing to bet whoever is running it is shouting that he has the inside dope from God, Satan, whomever." "It's insane," Charlie whispered. "Remember Jonestown. Those were Americans, even though they no longer lived in the 48, and nearly 1,000 of them committed suicide because of some damn nutcase who told them to drink Kool-Aid laced with poison because God had ordered it through him. Look, you get people scared, then you knock out every prop that we've taken for granted. After these last 60 days, I bet there's a dozen prophets running around this country saying, 'Follow me,' and even if but 0.1% of the survivors do so, that will still be hundreds of thousands of barbarians on the march and the rest of us running, scared shitless of them. Damn our enemies who did this to us. They knew us well," John sighed. "They knew human nature too well, and just how fragile civilization is, and how tough it is to defend it. Something we forgot." No one spoke until Don finally stirred. "I flew back along the interstate," he said softly. "I counted, between Morganton, Old Fort, and on the road, about 250 vehicles total."
1,000 to 1,500 people, then," Washington said.
"And just remember this, gentlemen. I was a trained artillery spotter, so I know how to count and how to spot."
"We don't doubt you," Charlie said.
"In this case, don't doubt me. Now, for the troubling aspect tactically."
"They're coming round the back," John said.
"Exactly. That's why I flew over here on my way back. I counted 2 dozen vehicles on the old dirt road right at the base of the mountains by Andrews Geyser, some on the abandoned paved road, a couple more farther up, near where the railroad track crosses over the old dirt road. They know our back door, and not just the interstate."
"In it on the old fire roads?"
Charlie asked. Don shook his head. "Hard to see with the summer canopy," he said.
"I doubt it," Washington interjected. "Unless they have a couple of local boys, those old fire roads are mazes. My bet is they'll stick to the old, abandoned paved road, the dirt road farther to the north, and the railroad track as the flanker, and they'll hit there first."
"I agree," Charlie said. "They could be here trying to maneuver into a flanking position by late afternoon," Don said. John nodded. "They must have a good military leader in there, knows his stuff, and has done a thorough recon on us by now and sees the flank roads as the opening move. They'll hit just before dawn," John said. "Hope to catch us sleeping. If I was one of them, Don here flying around would tell me that what's waiting for them has some kind of warning, so they will move fast rather than give us time to prepare.
We can pray they're just a mob that overruns by numbers and surprise, but it looks like there are some ex-military with them. Worst case, they got a couple of recon types who know how to figure out the ground, the defenses, the approaches, and formulate the plan of attack. Their advance party is an old fort to secure the place for the rest of them later today. I'd bet by late afternoon their advance will start probing, and we've got to meet them forward of the potential line of battle. They see our setup, get a good judgment on our strength, we'll have even more problems holding. They'll logger in Old Fort tonight and tear the place apart, then hit us before dawn.
"We'll be prepared," Washington said sharply and stood up.
"We feed the troops, then move them into position today. Washington, we've talked about this scenario, so we both know the plans. I want officers' briefing within the hour. Tom, start to evacuate all homes behind our fallback line beyond the old toll road, as we've talked about before. Charlie, I want every citizen who can carry a gun as our reserve. Mr. Barber, I hope you can stay up in the air most of the day. Keep high, though, sir. Real high. Just keep an eye on their movements," John said. Washington looked around the room, a thin smile on his face. Charlie, shriveled with emaciation, said nothing, but his gaze communicated volumes. John was now in charge.
"I think we should get to work, gentlemen," John said.
Tom headed back to his car with Don by his side. Washington looked over at John and Charlie.
"Gentlemen, I think it's important you join us in chapel and for our meal."
2 hours later, after the officers' briefing and a map exercise, the 1 to 25,000 geological survey maps taken from the small map store in Black Mountain spread out on the table, John felt everyone understood their mission. Several of the platoon leaders were students, Jeremiah and Phil having been promoted to second lieutenants in the first and second platoons of Company A. The others were vets from around the town, a good sprinkling of men from Desert Storm, a few from Nam. John walked into the dining hall. Strange. It still looked basically the same. The counter, where kids used to get their meal cards swiped with a laser scanner, circular tables, the twin doors leading into the food serving area. It was a room filled with a lot of happy memories, and a few poignant ones. This school was unlike what he had expected when he had first come here. He feared that his old commandant, in his rush to get John a job where Mary once lived, had most likely hooked him into some fundamentalist camp meeting. Not that he had any particular objection on a philosophical level as an American, but still he was a Catholic kid from Jersey. His fears could not be farther from the truth. It had turned into the warmest place he had ever worked in. He had been greeted with open arms into a community where friendly intellectual debate was encouraged. Though a few might be a bit judgmental, most were actually very open-minded, saying that was the true spirit of what Christ tried to teach, and not the nuttiness most outside the South believed of them, and all were guided by a desire to put their students first. The school was better than John ever imagined, and now, at this moment, he realized yet again just how much he loved them all, especially the kids, now sitting at the tables, decked out in camo gear, weapons stacked along the walls. The tradition with faculty was not to eat segregated off, but rather to join a table with their students, laugh, debate, argue, tease, stimulate. Mary had attended this college her first year before transferring to far more competitive Duke, and coming here was coming home for her. Several of the professors had even taught her long ago. Towards the end, she often came here to join John for lunch, and always kids would gather round their table, and those who fully knew her condition would usually leave her with a kiss to the forehead, an embrace, and, "I'm praying for you every day, ma'am." And then she was gone. But still, in the 4 years afterwards, so many happy days here, of shared meals, of the absolutely ridiculous but still touching dumb skits by the faculty for the senior breakfast the day before their graduation. But now,
The cafeteria lines were closed, the food service off to the far side, tables set up near the back door, the grill outside smoking madly with the slabs of bear meat. Most of the students had already taken their plates, each proportion carefully cut, a slab of bear meat, some greens, a cup of herbal tea, that was it. But still a pound or more of meat, while downtown at this moment everyone else was getting thin soup with just a couple ounces of meat mixed in. And yet, in spite of their hunger, they remained restrained. None had yet to cut in. All sat around their tables, talking, but not touching the food. John looked over at Charlie.
"You will eat," John said sharply.
"John?"
"Charlie, you will eat."
He pushed Charlie forward, and they joined the back of the line. It only took a few seconds before they were handed the plate, the piece of meat already cut. John noticed that the cooking staff actually had a scale behind the carving table, each piece of meat thrown on it before being put on a plate. Maybe the measurement would be off by an ounce or two one way or the other, but still it was a message to stifle any arguments. John followed Washington to a table set directly in front of the now-closed doors that had once opened onto the cafeteria line. As they reached their table, the room fell silent. All eyes turned towards them. Without prompting, Reverend Abel stepped forward and offered the blessing and finished, John and a few others making the sign of the cross. But Washington remained standing.
"I am proud of you," Washington said.
The room was absolutely silent, no matter how longingly some looked at the feast before them, a largesse of meat not seen in weeks.
"I am proud of all of you, everyone. Those who are bringing in food for us, especially our marksman Brett Huffman."
Brett, who had dropped the bear, stood up, and there was a round of applause and cheering.
"But also for all the rest of you. Those of you gathering, those of you searching, those of you in jobs some might think unglamorous, the work in the refugee center, the isolation ward, the infirmary, the woodcutting crews." He looked around the room. "Tonight or tomorrow, we face battle."
A murmur swept through the room.
"You've heard the rumors about a group called the Posse. We just received intelligence they are headed this way."
No one spoke, but John could see the anxious looks back and forth.
"There will be battle by this time tomorrow, and some of you will die. I have never lied to you. I never will. Some of you will die."
And now he had their attention like never before.
"You are now soldiers, every one of you. Those of you who train for it and those who have not. Every student of this college is now mobilized, as we previously discussed. Those who are not assigned to our two combat companies will fall in as medics, messengers, and in the other jobs you have been trained for. I expect all of you to do your duty as soldiers."
Washington turned and started to sit down. Before John even quite realized what he was doing, he stood up. A few had started to cut into their meal, but as he stood, they stopped, looking towards him.
"Tonight, tomorrow, you will fight. It is, tragically, the day you grow up, and you will never be able to turn back from. You are the defenders of thousands of people in this town who are now too weak to defend themselves. And now I will be blunt. I will fall silent for a moment, and I want you to look at the meal before you. That food is food sacrificed by others to give you strength to defend them and yourselves."
He did fall silent, and no one spoke, nearly all looking down at their plates.
"Think of—" and he actually chuckled sadly. "Think of how 2 months back we complained about the food here, filled our plates, then tossed half of it out. And now, tonight, you will face men and women who will kill you and everyone else for that piece of meat on your plate you would have thrown out but 2 months back."
He hesitated, but knew it had to be said.
or even your own flesh, if they win. Because not 40 miles from here, this evil band is slaughtering human beings for food.
There was an uncomfortable stirring. So for everything you eat now, know that but 2 miles from here, down in the town of Black Mountain, half a dozen died of starvation this morning. Died so you can eat, and have strength to survive and defend.
He sighed, started to sit down, and then stopped.
Some of you were in my classes on military history. You know how we so casually talked of wars past, the suffering, remote. You remember some of the speakers I've brought in, veterans of that generation we now call the greatest generation.
He braced himself, looking around the room, and now there were tears in his eyes.
Tonight, tomorrow, in years to come, you will, you must be, the greatest generation. You must win this fight. Then, remembering all that America was, you must rebuild her, and never forget.
He sighed, lowering his head.
Never forget.
He sat down, and for a moment there was silence. Laura, the girl in the choir, stood up and raised her voice.
Oh, say can you see, by the dawn's early light.
Instantly, all were standing, singing as well, and never had he heard it sung thus. He looked at them and tried to sing, unable to do so, overcome by emotion. The last stanza finished, a cheer erupted, and all sat down, except for Laura. She smiled at John, and half a dozen of the choir came to join her, and together they started to sing again, even as their comrades ate.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling, from glen to glen and down the mountainside.
John lowered his head, gazing at his meal. Perhaps half, maybe a quarter for myself, he thought. The rest for Jen, the kids, and Ginger. The meal done, there was a procession, led by the American flag, the school banner, and their fifer playing, over to the Chapel of the Prodigal, with its famous fresco painted by Ben Long. The service had to be short and to the point, for John had warned Reverend Abel that time was pressing. They had opened with the Lord's Prayer, and just as they finished, the back doors of the chapel opened, and in hobbled President Hunt, leaning on the arm of a student for strength. All stood, many with tears in their eyes. President Hunt took the front, standing beneath the painting, and then slowly drew a Bible out of his pocket.
"I carried this Bible in Nam," he said, his voice husky, weak. "I held it close the night I was wounded and lost my leg. There is a psalm I read every night I was there, and I wish to share it with you. We call it the Soldier's Psalm, the 91st.
He half opened the Bible, but it was obvious he knew the prayer by heart.
"He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty."
As he spoke, his voice gained strength.
"Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday."
It was mid-afternoon when John at last returned home. The entire town was astir, at least those still with the strength to move. Don had flown a second mission and returned with word that the posse was indeed moving, already past Marion. The first skirmish had erupted halfway down the mountain in Swannanoa Gap,
ironically not far from where, over 140 years earlier, in perhaps the last battle in the East during the Civil War, Confederate militia had fought to turn back Yankee raiders. The half-dozen advancing up the abandoned paved road had been wiped out near where the old overlook and hot dog stand had been. Another skirmish erupted along the dirt road farther to the north, long-distance sniping, one student soon dead from it and another missing. In town, those men still with any strength were forming up, deploying into a secondary line. Charlie was in the town hall and fuming with rage. He had called in the report to Asheville, begging for support, and they had written Black Mountain off. They claimed a group was approaching them from the south and had already torched Hendersonville, and there was no defensive bottleneck to keep them back. Everything they had was committed to that direction. Tom reported, though, that Asheville's barrier, just short of Exit 53, the narrow bottleneck of the interstate on I-40, was now heavily manned by Asheville militia, but they were not coming forward to help pitch in. Black Mountain and Swannanoa were on their own, Asheville most likely figuring they could take the blow, and if the invaders were repulsed, that would be great. If the defenders were overrun, the opposition would be so weakened that they would not have the strength for a final push. Payback, perhaps, for the defiance over the refugees, even though Charlie had warned that if the town fell, the last thing he would do would be blow the water main, and Asheville be damned. At 3 in the afternoon, the militia, like something out of long ago, had marched through the town, Pfeiffer in the lead wearing his Union capy and blue jacket, playing Yankee Doodle over and over, complete as well to a drummer from the high school and a flag-bearer, forming a tableau like the old painting. The street was lined with starving civilians who cheered them and wept as they passed. A few could remember such parades from 60 years past, and could not help but wonder at this, the sight in their own hometown of kids marching off, as from long ago, to fight others who but 2 months back were part of the same country. Their training uniforms of college blue were now replaced with camo, donated by civilians of the town, a mixed lot of hunting gear, some military surplus, some of it way too big for the smaller girls in the ranks, but still it lent a military air. Some of the vets in the ranks sported helmets, and more than a few of them were toting firearms that would have triggered an ATF raid in the old days. A couple of Thompsons, AK-47s, street sweepers, a frightful-looking 50-caliber sniper rifle, and a number of exotic-looking assault rifles. Piled in the back of a truck were satchel charges, some primitive mines, and hundreds of tin cans packed with scrap metal and a blasting charge, to be lit with a match, then thrown. Making them had been a tricky business, and one student had been killed and two wounded just after church service while packing a grenade when the charge went off. It was indeed like something from long ago, John thought, watching as they came down Black Mountain Road and turned onto State Street, heading east to the Gap. He stood to attention at the corner and saluted, standing thus until the last of the two companies of infantry and the company of auxiliary supports had passed. Though it was a solemn moment, he caught the eye of more than one of his former students, a flash of a smile, a subtle wave, as if somehow they were still kids play-acting, even as they toted rifles, shotguns, satchel charges, homemade bazookas, and grenades. He and Washington had nearly come to blows arguing about the plan, and for a few moments John felt that the 2 months of Washington calling him colonel had been nothing more than tradition and play-acting. And yet, in the end, Washington had at last deferred, though he warned it would triple their casualties and maybe cost them the war. After the passage of the militia up to the Gap, John then briefed the hundreds of civilian volunteers, some barely able to stand, as to their task and where to deploy, while Charlie made sure that two precious cattle would be taken up to the front, and there slaughtered and cooked, with all being able to fill their stomachs before the fight. Keller had pitched a fit over that, claiming it was better they went in with empty stomachs in case of gut wounds, but Washington and John had won out.
Better to lose some that way than have half the army collapse from hunger pains. The last few precious bottles of vitamins had been pulled out, and each combatant swallowed a double dose as well. Carl was leading down over 500 more from Swannanoa, though still able to heft a gun and fight. John finally felt that he had time to get away and get his family out. Their home was on what was being defined now as the front line, and he had decided to move his family back up into the cove near the college. Jen's home, though abandoned for nearly 2 months, was still intact, though scavenged through, with a door broken along with some windows. He pulled into his driveway, and with all that had happened, he realized that he had left but 9 hours before. The two bodies were still out on the deck. The meat wagon had not come. In the heat, they were now drawing swarms of flies. Jen stood in the doorway, and as he got out of the car, Ginger came up, head lowered, whimpering, almost scared, and Jennifer flung herself into his arms. "Daddy!" And she started to cry. He suddenly realized that he had become so preoccupied with the approach of the posse that he had all but forgotten what had transpired here just this morning. Jen came up to him, and the look in her eyes told him something was wrong. Had there been more of them? "Everyone okay?" John gasped. "Yes, we're okay." "Thank God."
"You look beat, John."
"I really can't explain much now, Jen, but we only have an hour to pack up and move out. We're moving up to your house."
"Why, for God's sake?"
"There's going to be a fight here by tomorrow. We're evacuating everyone on both sides of the highway."
"John, we all need to sit down and talk."
He felt Jennifer still in his arms. He hugged her. "I'm sorry about Zach, sweetie. He was a brave doggie. The best."
"I know, Daddy."
"John, there's something else," Jen said. He looked at her.
"John, come inside with me, please."
Too much was happening, and her tone set him to a near panic. Was it something about Jennifer? He broke her embrace and looked at her. Her features, though pinched and yellow, had not changed much.
"Jennifer, honey, I think Ginger needs to play," Jen said.
Her voice was not a suggestion, and Jennifer registered it.
"Okay, Grandma.
And make sure she stays away from those bodies out on the deck."
The way Jen said it, the message of those words, struck John as yet another breakdown. Tell your kid to go out and play with the dog, but stay away from the men Daddy had shot during the night, because your beloved Golden might suddenly look at them as a meal. He followed Jen into the living room. Elizabeth and Ben were sitting together on the sofa holding hands, and somehow at that instant, John knew. To his surprise, Michaela was standing in the corner of the room, half-turned, looking at him. Elizabeth looked up at him and took a deep breath.
"Daddy, I'm pregnant."
Absolutely thunderstruck, he couldn't speak. He looked at Ben, whose arm was now protectively around Elizabeth's shoulder. Ben tried to look him straight in the eye and then lowered his gaze. John turned away, fearful of what he might say or do, lit another cigarette, and walked to the bay window. Jen came up to his side. Behind him, Elizabeth started to cry, and Ben was whispering to her.
"John?"
It was Jen standing by his side, whispering.
"For God's sake, John, do the right thing."
He turned and looked back. "How?" was all he could say. And he instantly realized the absurdity of it. At 16, Elizabeth already so looked like her mother, and he remembered when they met she was 20, he was 21. Of course he knew how. But this was his baby girl, who used to smother him with smoochies and say she would love him forever. He walked towards them, and to his horror he saw fear in Elizabeth's eyes. Ben then stood up.
"Sir? If there's blame, it's mine."
His voice was trembling and broke into an adolescent squeak.
"It's my fault, not hers."
"No, Ben, both of us."
She stood up and put her arm around him.
"Daddy, we love each other."
He slowly sat down, shaking his head. "My God," he sighed. "Your kid's in high school, college ahead."
"Not anymore,"
Elizabeth said. And now there was some strength to her voice.
"Daddy, that's all over now. All over."
He looked up at her. She had always been slender, like her mom, but was even more so now. Though he didn't want to say it, he did. "Maybe the lack of food. Maybe that's why you're late."
"No, John."
And for the first time, Michaela spoke. "I found a test kit. It's positive. She's going to have a baby." As she said the word baby, Elizabeth and Ben, like so many across the ages, looked at each other and smiled. John looked at them. Again, how slender she was, losing weight. Though he was a Catholic, even a non-practicing one, the thought of abortion flickered, even though it was anathema to him. Having this baby might kill her. "I need to think," John said, and stood up, heading to his office. He stopped at the doorway and then looked back. "We have to evacuate in 1 hour, so start packing." He couldn't say any more and left the room. He sat down at his desk, the bottle behind it gone, damn it. He fumbled in his breast pocket and pulled out the smokes. He took one out and lit it. Numbed, he looked out the window, at the backyard where Jennifer was throwing a stick to Ginger, who, though moving slowly, still was trying to play.
"John?"
He looked up. It was Michaela.
"Am I intruding?"
"Yes and no."
"Can I join you?"
He nodded, and she took the chair by his desk.
"What are you thinking?"
she asked. He sighed. "The whole world has gone to hell. You know I killed 2 men this morning?"
"I saw the bodies, and they deserved it."
"And Zach?"
"I'm sorry, John, about him. He died well, though."
John lowered his head. Was it only hours ago, he thought. "There's a barbarian horde coming this way, and by tomorrow they might overrun us. If they do, all this will be moot. Jennifer out there will be dead. If lucky, you and Elizabeth dead, all of us dead. The country, dead."
"That's why you have to accept what happened with Elizabeth."
"What? She's a kid, Michaela. She was going to be a junior in high school. That son of a..." He hesitated. "Ben, a senior... My God, Michaela, accept it?
Kids younger than them have been getting pregnant for thousands of years, especially in wartime.
Not my baby."
"Yes, your baby."
And she reached out and touched his knee.
"Listen, John, you know and I know there isn't much chance, and they know it too. They think they're in love. For God's sake, I hope they are in love. They want that taste of life as much as you did, as I did, as any of us do."
He looked at her and found he couldn't respond.
"Give them your blessings. I know it will be hard, but do it. I know the risk she faces as much, maybe more than you do. Give her that blessing for her to carry with her and give her strength."
He saw tears in Michaela's eyes.
"She's a good kid, John. You and Mary raised her well. Don't turn this into a moral question now. They were 2 scared kids, the world going to hell around them. It was all but inevitable it would happen. If not for this damn war, it'd have been different, but it's not. And you have to accept that."
He nodded. "Tell Ben to come in here." A moment later, Ben was at the door, standing straight, eyes wide. John motioned for him to come into his office.
"Sir, you can do what you want to me, sir. Just don't blame your daughter."
And at that moment, John softened. He could see the kid half expected to see a shotgun or face a damn good thrashing. He had the guts to take it. "You love my daughter?"
"More than anything in the world, sir."
"Well, so do I. Her and Jennifer."
I know that, sir.
John nodded. He didn't want to think too much further about how Ben loved her. No father really would, but John could see that, though 17, Ben was trying to be a man at this moment, and would have to be a man in the days to come. John stood up, hesitated, then extended his hand.
"Thank you, sir."
And Ben's voice cracked a bit. John nodded. "Just don't call me Dad yet," he finally said. "I'm not ready for that."
"Yes, sir."
He knew Elizabeth in the next room had heard the exchange, and she came through the doorway and flung herself into his arms.
"Thank you, Daddy."
Now he did fill up. Her voice still sounded like his little girl. He saw Jennifer standing in the doorway as well, smiling.
"So, you're not going to kill them?"
Jennifer asked, and that broke the tension for the moment. "No, of course not, sweetie."
"Okay."
And she was gone. He felt there was some sort of ritual required now, and as Elizabeth slipped out of his arms, he took her hand and placed it in Ben's hand. "Once the next few days are over, well, since our priest disappeared, we'll ask Reverend Black to do the marriage." Elizabeth smiled and leaned against Ben's shoulder. "But we got other worries now. Like I said, we're leaving this house within the hour. Girls, you better pack what you can fit into the car. Ben, get down to your family and tell them to get out as well. Have them come up to the cove for now. They can stay with us if need be." Elizabeth and Ben looked at each other. "You can do your goodbyes later. There isn't time to waste. Tell your folks I'll drive your family up to the cove in an hour, so be ready." He hesitated, and suddenly it truly hurt what he was about to say next. "Ben, we're going to be attacked, most likely early tomorrow morning. You'll have to fall in with the town reserve guard."
"Yes, sir?"
Elizabeth started to cry.
"Daddy, can he stay with us in the cove?"
"Absolutely not,"
Ben replied forcefully. She looked at Ben and then back at John, eyes filled with tears. "It's his duty now," John said softly. Ben looked at Elizabeth, hesitated, then kissed her lightly on the lips. "I'll see you later, sweetheart." She couldn't reply, hugging him fiercely. "Elizabeth, go help your grandmother and Jennifer pack." She hesitated. Ben broke free from her embrace.
"I'll be okay, sweetheart. Go on now."
Crying, she left the room, and Ben turned back to face John. John opened his gun cabinet, scanned the weapons, and pulled out one of his best, an M1 carbine. "You know how to load and handle this?
Remember, sir, you took me shooting with it last year?"
John checked the clip. It was full, and there was a box of extra ammunition for it. "Take this. You're going to need it." Ben nodded. "Report to Charlie Fuller. Tell him I've assigned you to be one of his runners."
"Sir, you are not keeping me back, are you?"
John lied with a shake of his head. "You'll be in the middle of it, son." Ben nodded solemnly, hefting the carbine and looking at it.
"Let me help Elizabeth first, if you don't mind, sir."
"Sure, you got a few minutes." He looked at John, eyes solemn.
"If anything happens to me, sir,"
John forced a smile.
"You'll be okay, Ben. Now go help Elizabeth."
"Yes, sir."
Ben left the room, and Michaela was standing at the doorway, smiling.
"You did the right thing," she said.
"Let me think about it." To his surprise, she came up and kissed him on the lips.
"I better get up to the conference center and evacuate the folks there. From what I just heard, I assume that will be in the middle of it."
John nodded. "I'll drive you up there. Charlie should be sending up some vehicles to get people out. We're evacuating everybody from here clear back to the town. Once you get your patients out, report to Doc Keller. I think you'd be most useful there."
"Is it going to be bad?"
John nodded again. "Real bad, I think." She squeezed his hand and went back to help the girls pack up. He looked around. What to take? The guns, of course. 7 rifles, including the original Civil War Springfield and the replica Hawkins 50 flintlock. Throw them in the trunk of the car for now. He scanned his office. What to take? The portrait of Mary, of course. And as he picked it up, he thought of Michaela in the next room. Neither would mind, he realized, with a sad smile. He took the picture out of its frame and slipped it into his pocket. He then checked the loads in the Glock and the shotgun and shouted for his family to get moving. Chapter 10 The entire mountainside, north and south of the interstate, was burning. He gazed at the inferno, feeling nothing, even though his home was somewhere within that blaze. Scattered shots still rang out. A holdout band of the posse was barricaded inside a single-story house facing the interstate on a side road a couple of hundred yards back from the gap. It was a key position because it looked down on both the interstate and the flanking approach of the abandoned paved road and the railroad. Two of his militia sprinted towards the building, approaching it from a blind spot where a truck was parked. They crawled under the truck, came out on the other side, and rolled up against the side of the building. One opened her backpack. The other took out a Zippo, flicked it to life, and touched the fuse. Inside was a 10-pound charge of black powder, packed into 3-inch PVC pipe, nails mixed in. The girl stood up and threw it through the smashed window, then collapsed backwards, shot in the chest. He could hear screaming inside the building, someone standing up trying to throw the backpack out, a fusillade of fire dropping him. The explosion seemed to tear off the side of the house. With harsh, guttural screams, a dozen militia were up, charging, pushing through the wreckage and into the smoke-filled house. Seconds later, several posse poured out the front door. None made it more than a dozen feet. Two more houses to go at the top of the ridge. A couple of dozen holdouts within, surrounded now on all sides. A barrage of Molotov cocktails rained onto the buildings. From within one, there were bursts of automatic weapons fire. The assault teams waited. In just 8 hours, they were veterans. No dumbass heroics, no follow-me charges. One of the buildings finally started to burn, and then the second. Suppressive fire pouring in through every window to keep those within down. It took 10 minutes, a dozen more Molotovs tossed against the side of the wooden structure to feed the flames, which finally went into the eaves of the house. It was ablaze now, screaming from inside. The front door burst open and the militia was waiting. Half a dozen were gunned down as they came out. The last two were women, falling to their knees, hands up. No one fired, and they crawled away from the inferno, then fell on their faces, crying for mercy. One house left, the one with the automatic fire. John, watching the fight, had a gut sense of who was in there. He picked up a megaphone. "I want prisoners from that house," he shouted. The house was ablaze. "Come out, and we won't shoot," John shouted. Seconds later, the door burst open, and 6 men and a woman staggered out, throwing weapons aside. "Down on your knees, hands over heads." They did as ordered, and the student militia circled in around them. The thunder of the battle was dying away now, a burst of shots from down near the second railroad tunnel, a volley from up on Rattlesnake Mountain, the louder sound now, the forest fire sweeping both sides of the interstate, driven by a westerly breeze. He looked around. Some of the militia coming out from cover, standing up cautiously, looking around. Most ducking when a sniper round zinged down from the ridge atop the pass. It was greeted seconds later with an explosive roar of fire, and then silence. One of the militia then standing atop the ridge, rifle held high, waved the all clear. John rose up from the side of the bridge over the interstate, walked around to the side, and slid down the slope and onto the pavement of the interstate, his action almost a signal that the war was over. Dozens more were standing, dazed, silent. He looked up the road to the pass but 100 yards away. It was a road paved with horrors. At nearly every step there were bodies twisted into the contortions that only the dead could hold, rivulets of blood pouring off the road into the storm gutters. It was a seething mass as well, hundreds of wounded. He turned and looked back down the highway towards exit 66 and raised his megaphone.
"Medics! Bring up the medics now!"
They had been waiting several hundred yards to the rear while the last of the posse were wiped out from the ridge, which they had successfully seized in the opening round of the fight. There must have been someone local with them, either willing or unwilling. 2 hours before dawn, 50 of them had emerged on the little-used Kazuma Trail, known only to hikers and mountain bikers, a path that led from the Piedmont below to the highest point on the crest overlooking the interstate and the flanking roads. Seizing the half-dozen houses up there, wiping out the defenders in a matter of minutes, they had enfilading fire down onto the gap itself, with the defenders there pinned, unable to fire back. Minutes later, the main assaults came in. 50 vehicles up the flanking road, men and women on foot going through the railroad tunnel, and a column of nearly 200 vehicles roaring up from Old Fort, led by a diesel truck with a snowplow mounted to the front. The forward barrier fell, and then the next fallback position, where he was standing now, the bridge over the highway, since the houses above were perfect positions to fire down on it. Though they were caught off guard by the surprise seizure of the houses and ridge above the gap, the rapid retreat had been part of his and Washington's plan all along. Washington was a superb Marine, a superb trainer and leader, but John did realize now that all the crap about his being colonel, Washington had been right on that, too. Washington's plan was a classic defense on the high ground, and John had vetoed it. "Almost as bad as losing would be our winning too easily," he had said. "We repulse them at the crest, they'll take losses, retreat, and then do one of two things. Either head off somewhere else, or wait until the time is right and get us. And I think it would be the latter." "Whoever is leading that band cannot afford even a single defeat. His own people will turn on him, kill him, and then come back yet again." John's worst nightmare was that after a sharp defeat, the posse would pull back to Old Fort, simply spread out a bit, loot, probe, and keep them on guard 24 hours a day, and wait them out. They'd make a mistake. There'd be a weak spot. The enemy would catch a guard asleep, attack the position at night in the middle of a storm. No, John wanted them over the ridge, let them take the gap, and then to lure them into a classic killing ground. "The mountains to either side can give us a canny or a classic Mongol envelopment," he argued. And students who had taken his classes and were now officers sitting in on the planning just the day before instantly grasped it. "Once in, I want them all in, and then I don't want one of them to get out alive." It was the plan that Washington warned would triple their casualties, but John argued in so doing they would annihilate the posse, rather than just drive it back with the threat of a return. The tragedy was that the first platoon of Company A, guarding the gap, was cut off in the opening move and not one of them made it out. That had nearly triggered a rout, as the survivors of the second platoon gave way too quickly at the second defensive line, the bridge at exit 66, and the nursing home overlooking it. It had been near run then. The attackers swarming forward, sensing victory, pushing hard, squeezing in where Route 70 ran within feet of the interstate, the very place where John had first met Michaela, her beamer now upended and piled into the defensive barrier line across the main line of defense, where the interstate curved up on a bridge that crossed the railroad tracks. It was a bridge poorly designed for traffic. Every ice storm, someone always spun out on that bridge, but if whoever had designed it was thinking of a battle, it was superb. It was like a hill with no flanks to worry about. Atop the bridge, a clear field of fire for a mile back up the road. Behind the bridge, a sharp slope up to where the old town water tank was, another superb position, and the flank there protected by a wide cut through the forest for the passage of high-tension lines, thus creating an open killing field against any of the posse trying to get to the tower. And then the trap itself. Concealed up on each flanking ridge, back near the gap, Company B, armed with the best long-range weapons the town could provide, high-powered deer rifles with scope mounts. Every house to either side of the interstate, several hundred homes, including his own and a trailer park, were rigged to burn, buckets of gas placed within each. Students who were not trained as soldiers were now pressed into service, so that when the signal was given, the siren on the fire truck sounding off combined with signal rockets, they were to go into action, moving fast on mountain bikes or mopeds, setting each house ablaze.